Hello, this is Susie Essman and Jeff Garland.
I'm here.
And we are the hosts of the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. Now, we're going to be rewatching and talking about every single episode, and we're going to break it down and give behind-the-scenes knowledge that a lot of people don't know, and we're going to be joined by special guests, including Larry David and Cheryl Hines, Richard Lewis, Bob Odenkirk, and so many more. And we're going to have clips, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. So listen to the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you happen to get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Dana Schwartz. You may know my voice from Noble Blood, Haleywood, or Stealing Superman. I'm hosting a new podcast, and we're calling it Very Special Episodes. A very special episode is stranger than fiction.
It sounds like it should be the next season of True Detective, these Canadian cops trying to solve this mystery of who spiked the chowder on the Titanic set.
Listen to Very Special Episodes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up, guys? Hola, ¿qué tal? It's your girl Cheekies from the Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies podcasts. And guess what? We're back for another season. Get ready for all new episodes where I'll be dishing out honest advice, discussing important topics like relationships, women's health, and spirituality. I'm sharing my experiences with you guys, and I feel that everything that I've gone through has made me a wiser person. And if I can help anyone else through my experiences, I feel like I'm living my godly purpose. Listen to Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On February 25th, 1993, police were called to a house in a remote area in Saskatchewan, Canada. They arrived to a horrific and bloody scene. 70-year-old Joseph Dolph was lying face down on his bedroom floor, dead. He had been beaten and stabbed multiple times. The house was in shambles, and there had obviously been a violent struggle. That morning, Odelia and Narissa Cusance and their cousin, Jason Cushane, were picked up by police. The sisters were held at the station for 5 days and questioned repeatedly without counsel.
These were two young Indigenous women trying to cope with police officers, white police officers, all male.
The interrogations were not recorded, and after days of questioning, both women signed statements admitting to taking part in the killing.
And on the basis of those unrecorded statements that the police alleged they gave after a trial before a judge and, of course, not surprisingly, an all-white jury, they were convicted the following year.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Odelia and Narissa Cusance. Odelia and Narissa Cusance are sisters, born 2 years apart and members of the Salto First Nation. They grew up on the Kiskus Reserve in Saskatchewan, Canada, along with an older brother and three other sisters.
And growing up in Kiskus, we all were called the village kids. We lived in a village.
This is Odelia, the older of the two, born in 1972.
Me and Narissa did not have our mother involved in our life, but our father was involved, and till the day he passed, he was always there for us.
I never actually knew my mother, but my dad, he was the best thing for me.
And that's Narissa. The sisters have always been close, and both girls adored their father.
He was quite a big man, I guess. He's 6'3". And he's really into sports. He's a hockey player himself, a basketball player, and he used to be coached on a team, on a reserve, I mean. We didn't have nothing to eat or no power, you know, as long as he was there, and that's what mattered to me.
He did his best. He wasn't perfect. Nobody's perfect.
Life for the girls growing up was rough. Canada's Indigenous populations have long faced systemic racism. Poverty, violence, and substance addiction were rampant on the reserve where they lived.
seeing people, relatives, trying to commit suicide, being babysat while our father trusted someone, and then having a relative commit suicide, shoot himself. And we were little kids getting put in a pattern. And, you know, we had a tough life.
But the Cuzon siblings looked out for each other. Odelia especially tried to protect her younger sisters.
I love my sisters. And I remember times where we did go hungry. We always used to tell each other to stay, you know, be strong, be strong. Sometimes it was tough.
Like generations of family members before them, Odelia and Narissa were sent away to residential schools at a very young age.
Like, my dad couldn't raise all of us kids on his own, and then we were sent to our grandparents and then to the residential schools. We went to Labrette boarding school, and then there's one called Merivale boarding school that we went to on Cowes' First Nation. You know, I think I was only 8, or I don't even know, I was so young when I went, and all I remember is loneliness.
Canada's Indian Residential School System, as it was called, was established in the 1870s with the goal of assimilating Indigenous children into white society. The schools were run by Catholic, Anglican, Methodist, and Presbyterian churches. For children like Odelia and Narissa, who had grown up surrounded by extended family and tribal elders on the reserve, being dropped into a Christian school education system was total culture shock.
They take away your esteem. They take away everything because it's like, it's an institution. And, you know, all a bunch of young kids that are, you know, we're just children being told to get up at a certain time in the morning, going to church, going, doing all this stuff and you're a kid.
Students were forced to sing and pray in Latin, while their own cultural and spiritual beliefs were stifled or beaten out of them. For those who didn't conform, punishment was swift and harsh.
And I remember one time wanting to go to the bathroom, and I got put in the middle of the dorm, had to kneel for hours. You know, as a child, I used to, you know, like 8, 7 years old, wishing to die. That's terrible. But who do you turn to? You know, but we survived it. We survived it.
Many survivors of the residential school system recall being severely beaten and repeatedly sexually assaulted by supervisors.
And then, Narissa, I think I read that you have like a spine problem with your back because of what happened to you at residential school.
Yeah, from trauma, from my body wasn't quite developed, so my bones are kind of whatever.
And that's from being attacked at the school, from being beaten.
Like, I have heavy blows to my body when it wasn't formed, I guess. I remember even as a child, I used to wonder why God was so mean, you know, to a kid.
The last of these schools was closed in 1996, but not before generations of Indigenous children had been permanently scarred, both physically and emotionally, by their treatment. This arguably contributed to the systemic disenfranchisement of Indigenous people in Canada, creating a highly vulnerable population.
How old were y'all when you left the school, and how did you get out of there?
My mother died when I was 14, and I think, I don't know how, 15 when I left boarding school.
Odelia dropped out of school and moved to Edmonton to live with family there. She continued to try to look out for her little sister, but Narissa was still having a hard time at school, and she'd been getting into trouble with the law starting at age 13.
What did you go to prison for the first time?
First time I was a young offender, me, for a stolen vehicle. Mm. And that's where it escalated. There was nothing violent. I never had any violence on my record till my adult charge.
Her time spent in prison started Narissa on the road to alcohol and hard drugs at a young age.
I never was introduced to that till I went to prison. Like, sure, I used to smoke the odd joints once in a while, but like take the odd pill, you know. I became an addict in prison.
By 1993, Odelia was 21 and Narissa was 18. They had both moved back to the Keys Coast Reserve and were living with their sister Zerlina and her husband and kids. Their 15-year-old cousin, Jason Cashane, lived across the road. On the night of February 24th, 1993, Jason stole 15 tablets of the drug Restoril from his grandma. He, Odelia, and Narissa all took the sedative, which is used to treat insomnia. It can cause severe drowsiness, and when combined with alcohol, periodic blackouts. Later that evening, Jason called an acquaintance, 70-year-old Joseph Dolph, to come and pick them up. Dolph had worked as a maintenance man at St. Philip's, one of the residential schools they had attended. He was known to regularly invite young Indigenous women and girls to his home. That night, Dolph wanted to party, and they all got in his car.
He picked them up, brought them to his fairly remote home in Kamsack, Saskatchewan. In fact, it was very remote, and provided them with beer and whiskey.
This is James Lockyer.
I'm Innocence Canada's counsel for the Cusan sisters, Adelia and Narissa.
With the Restoril already in their systems, the sisters became more and more inebriated. Later, they would have a hard time remembering everything that occurred that night. Jason later testified that Dolph and Odelia left to go get beer. When they returned, they all continued drinking, finishing off a large bottle of whiskey Dolph provided. And it seemed he had an agenda.
And during the course of the evening, Dolph tried to persuade Odelia and Narissa to have sex with him. They refused, and it led to some dispute between them.
Around 1 o'clock in the morning, they persuaded Dolph to drive them all home.
And on the way home, Dolph realized that he had $300 missing from his wallet. And he decided to turn around and go back home.
Back at the house, Dolph accused the three of stealing the money from him. They denied it, and an argument ensued. The next day, the police were called to Joseph Dolph's home. When they entered, they found the place completely trashed, with furniture turned over and talcum powder sprinkled all around. Dolph's body was face down in the bedroom. He'd been stabbed over a dozen times in the chest, abdomen, back, and left arm. A knife was still in his stomach, and a phone cord was wrapped around his neck. There were blunt force injuries on his head and a fracture near his right eye. When the police started asking around the community about who could have been involved,
they quickly ascertained that the two Cusan sisters and Jason had been at his house that night. They were all three arrested.
That morning, Odelia, Narissa, and Jason were taken to the Kamsack Police Detachment by the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The sisters were stripped to their underwear and placed in concrete cells with only raincoats to wear. Later, they were given sweatpants and sweatshirts. Both women spoke with lawyers who told the police that their clients were not to be questioned. The next day, the Justice of the Peace ordered that the sisters be remanded to the nearest jail. This was Friday.
However, the police ignored that order and kept them until the following Tuesday in the police detachment, so that they were a matter of 8 steps from numerous all-white, all-male police officers in the Kamsack detachment. In Canada, if you want to hold someone for more than 24 hours in police custody, you have to get judicial authorization, and they were held in the cells there for a total of 5 nights. And on these most unpleasant cells, which I've seen, they have a 17th century appearance to them, very thick white concrete walls, probably 12, 15 inches thick, with bars going from ceiling to ground, and, you know, hard, cold steel bunks with no bedding. So, you know, of its very nature, highly intimidating for both of them.
Meanwhile, their cousin Jason was also being questioned. And on the very first day,
Jason confessed to the homicide and his confession was recorded on tape, a tape recording that somehow was not available when it came to the questioning of Nerissa and Adelia to being the one who did the stabbings.
The sisters were told that Jason had confessed to the murder and that he implicated them as well, which was later found not to be true. The two were questioned repeatedly by the RCMP over the next 4 days.
They have memory of being extremely scared, of course, and frightened around all these men, these, what to them, were big, burly, white men, continually bringing them out of the cells and questioning them again and putting them back in and questioning them again over day after day. They had no lawyers, and the police knew what they wanted. They knew what they were doing. They had to get these two girls to say things that somehow tied them into Mr. Dolph's murder. The police alleged that they gave verbal statements, not recorded, that slowly but surely amounted to more incriminating statements. So as I say, they got Adelia to admit one stab wound out of more than 40.
How did they get the girls to confess to this?
There's no doubt there was intimidating tactics used. These were two young indigenous women trying to cope with police officers, white police officers, all male. More than that, they were both victims of the residential school system. They were highly vulnerable individuals. We'll never really know exactly what happened because none of it was recorded. They had no lawyers. It was made clear to them what they wanted to hear. The policemen wrote out what they claimed the girls were saying. One of Nerissa's statements was clearly not her words. And on the basis of those unrecorded statements that the police alleged they gave, they were convicted the following year after a trial before a judge and, of course, not surprisingly, an all-white jury.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, this is Dana Schwartz. You may know my voice from Noble Blood, Haleywood, or Stealing Superman. I'm hosting a new podcast, and we're calling it Very Special Episodes.
1 week, we'll be on the case with special agents from NASA as they crack down on black market moon rocks.
H. Ross Perot's on the other side and he goes, "Hello, Joe, how can I help you?" I said, "Mr. Perot, what we need is $5 million to get back a moon rock."
Another week, we'll unravel a 90s Hollywood mystery.
It sounds like it should be the next season of True Detective or something. These Canadian cops trying to solve this 25-year-old mystery of who spiked the chowder on the Titanic set.
A very special episode is Stranger Than Fiction. It's normal people plopped down in extraordinary circumstances. It's a story where you say, this should be a movie. Listen to Very Special Episodes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Susie Essman.
And I am Jeff Garland.
Yes, you are. And we are the hosts of the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. We're going to watch every single episode. It's 122, including the pilot, and we're going to break them down.
And by the way, most of these episodes I have not seen for 20 years.
Yeah, me too. We're going to have guest stars and people that are very important to the show, like Larry David.
I did once try and stop a woman who was about to get hit by a car. I screamed out, "Watch out!" And she said, "Don't you tell me what to do!"
And Cheryl Hines.
Why can't you just lighten up and have a good time?
And Richard Lewis.
How am I going to tell him I'm going to leave now?
Can you do it on the phone? Do you have to do it in person? What's
not
the deal?
Not canceling cable. You have to go in. He's a human being. He's helped you.
And then we're going to have behind-the-scenes information. Tidbits.
Yes, tidbits is a great word.
Anyway, we're both a wealth of knowledge about this show because we've been doing it for 23 years. So subscribe now, and you could listen to the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you happen to get your podcasts.
What up, guys? Hola, ¿qué tal? It's your girl Cheekies from the Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies podcasts. You've been with me for season 1 and 2, and now I'm back with season 3.
Yay!
I am so excited, you guys. Get ready for all new episodes where I'll be dishing out honest advice and discussing important topics like relationships, women's health, and spirituality. For a long time, I was afraid of falling in love. So I had to, and this is a mantra of mine or an affirmation every morning where I tell myself, it is safe for me to love and to be loved. I've heard this a lot, that people think that I'm conceited, that I'm a mamona. And a mamona means that you just think you're better than everyone else. I don't know if it's because of how I act in my videos sometimes. I'm like, I'm a baddie. I don't know what it is, but I'm chill. It's Cheekies and Chill. Hello. Listen to Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies as part of the My Cultura podcast network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Adelia and Narissa testified at their trials. The trouble is that they had it made clear to them that it was not in their interest to try and challenge the versions of events given by the RCMP officers in front of the jury, because if they did, they'd be disbelieved.
After the years they'd spent at residential schools, the girls were conditioned to succumb to authority and believed no one would help them.
They were told to stay in line. As to how they were treated by the police, who of course testified that they treated them well, et cetera, for those 5 days, even though they shouldn't have been in the police station for four of them. And no one really seemed to see much wrong with that at trial. Certainly the trial judge didn't. Her name was Justice Gunn was her name. So they tried to fall into step, you might say, with what the RCMP officers said. Not entirely, but they did their best to. So that their claim that they had not been involved in Mr. Dolph's murder would be more likely believed. And this was classic for those times, that Indigenous people were told by their own lawyers that, you know, if it's your word against the police, no one's going to believe you.
So for people in the U.S. who don't know about the systemic abuses of Indigenous people in Canada, can you describe that a little bit?
Well, it's not unlike your country. It's very much a colonial history where we colonized the original peoples of our part of the continent, and you did the same in your part of the continent. The RCMP has in the past and still to this day engages in systemic racism towards Indigenous peoples. That's acknowledged publicly, I might say with some reluctance, but nevertheless acknowledged. The case of Adelia and Narissa just smacks of this. Here we have two young girls, both Indigenous. I mean, if you or I had been the ones arrested in February of 1993, they wouldn't have held us in the police cells for 5 days in complete violation of a judicial order. They're victims of systemic discrimination, and it obviously includes within it then the failure of the police to make any attempt to record any of the interviews, despite the fact that the recording equipment was right there in the police station. Their failure to obey a judicial order for day after day after day. Their failure to in any way document the conditions of both Adelia and Narissa, their level of intoxication on arrest, their level of drug taking. And overall, the fact that it's become known in the last 20 years that false confessions are a regular feature of wrongful convictions. And false confessions, above all, come from those who are vulnerable in the first place.
Okay, so going back to the trial, Adelia and Narissa were tried in the Court of Queen's Bench in Yorkton before Madam Justice Ellen Gunn. And as you said earlier, it was an all-white jury. And we've heard how the sisters were basically forced to incriminate themselves at trial. But what did their lawyers present in defense?
Their defense was that the two women were both drunk at the time, and therefore their responsibility meant they should only be convicted of manslaughter. It was like a sort of a semi-surrender defense.
So they didn't bring up a false confession?
No, they did not. Jason was called by the Crown as a witness. And indeed, when he testified at trial, he implicated himself and said that he was the one who had stabbed Mr. Dolph.
At trial, Jason told a more complete story of what happened that night. Jason said once they all returned to the house, Joseph Dolph went looking for his missing money. They all got into an altercation, and Nerissa hit Dolph on the head with a porcelain ornament, which broke, and a tea kettle. Odelia hit him with a whiskey bottle. Jason punched Dolph, who was going after Nerissa, then followed him into the bedroom and choked him with a telephone cord. Then he grabbed a knife from the kitchen and stabbed Dolph, repeatedly, finally leaving the knife in his body. He said Odelia and Nerissa were in another room together, crying. After Jason finished assaulting Dolph, the three trashed the house. Then Jason took Dolph's keys and drove them all home. It would later come out that Jason was told to implicate Odelia and Nerissa by saying they had hit Dolph. According to Jason, they actually hadn't. He had been the sole attacker. However, Jason's testimony did corroborate the sisters' assertion that they were not the ones who had killed Joseph Dolph. He was.
He'd already pleaded guilty to the crime. He was a 15-year-old, so he pleaded guilty under the Young Offenders Act and received a sentence of 5 years. So the real killer was in for 5 years. And at his age, he shouldn't have been in for longer than that, I would hasten to add.
Was he asked directly if the girls did, and did he say no, or was he just not asked? Okay. And he said no, they did not.
Yes, he said he's the one who stabbed them.
Wow. So even though they were not implicated at the trial by him, they're still convicted.
Yes.
Hey, this is Dana Schwartz. You may know my voice from Noble Blood, Haleywood, or Stealing Superman. I'm hosting a new podcast, and we're calling it Very Special Episodes.
1 week, we'll be on the case with special agents from NASA as they crack down on black market moon rocks.
H. Ross Perot's on the other side, and he goes, "Hello, Joe, how can I help you?" I said, "Mr. Perot, what we need is $5 million to get back a moon rock."
Another week, we'll unravel a 90s Hollywood mystery.
It sounds like it should be the next season of True Detective or something. These Canadian cops trying to solve this 25-year-old mystery of who spiked the chowder on the Titanic set.
A very special episode is Stranger Than Fiction. It's normal people plopped down in extraordinary circumstances. It's a story where you say, this should be a movie. Listen to Very Special Episodes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Susie Essman.
And I am Jeff Garland.
Yes, you are. And we are the hosts of the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. We're going to watch every single episode. It's 122, including the pilot, and we're going to break them down.
And by the way, most of these episodes I have not seen for 20 years.
Yeah, me too. We're going to have guest stars and people that are very important to the show, like Larry David.
I did once try and stop a woman who was about to get hit by a car. I screamed out, "Watch out!" And she said, "Don't you tell me what to do!"
And Cheryl Hines.
Why can't you just lighten up and have a good time?
And Richard Lewis.
How am I going to tell him I'm going to leave now?
Can you do it on the phone? Do you have to do it in person? What's
not
the deal?
Not canceling cable. You have to go in. He's a human being. He's helped you.
And then we're going to have behind-the-scenes information. Tidbits.
Yes, tidbits is a great word.
Anyway, we're both a wealth of knowledge about this show because we've been doing it for 23 years. So subscribe now, and you could listen to the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you happen to get your podcasts.
What up, guys? Hola, ¿qué tal? It's your girl Cheekies from the Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies podcasts. You've been with me for season 1 and 2, and now I'm back with season 3.
Yay!
I am so excited, you guys. Get ready for all new episodes where I'll be dishing out honest advice and discussing important topics like relationships, women's health, and spirituality. For a long time, I was afraid of falling in love. So I had to, and this is a mantra of mine or an affirmation every morning where I tell myself, it is safe for me to love and to be loved. I've heard this a lot, that people think that I'm conceited, that I'm a mamona. And a mamona means that you just think you're better than everyone else. I don't know if it's because of how I act in my videos sometimes. I'm like, I'm a baddie. I don't know what it is, but I'm chill. It's Cheekies and Chill. Hello. Listen to Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies as part of the My Cultura podcast network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On February 4th, 1994, Odelia and Nerissa were convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. with the possibility of parole in 10 years. While she was incarcerated, Odelia stayed connected with her partner, Jay, whom she'd known since she was 18. In 2001, she gave birth to their daughter, and 6 years later, twin girls.
My oldest daughter, Haley, she lived in prison for 2 years with me.
What was that like living with your daughter in prison?
I was just grateful she was there with me. Yes, it was like, you know, but you know what? My daughter today, she's very outspoken because she had a lot of aunties and cookums in there to take care of her. You know, like she was allowed to be a child in there.
Were there other women with kids?
Yeah.
Wow. And so once your daughters, you know, left prison and were older, who were they living with? And what was that like to try and parent from behind bars?
My daughters, they were living with their father, and he took care of them, and he brought them to visit me every couple months. I talked on the phone with them a lot.
How do you do being a dad?
I think he did pretty good. Kind of spoiled our girls, but in a good way, though.
While in prison, Odelia also earned her GED, completed a number of programs, and worked in the library, horticulture, kitchen, and daycare. She grew to be respected as a leader by both prisoners and staff. Narissa earned a degree in adult education from the University of Saskatoon while at the Edmonton Institution for Women, the first incarcerated person to graduate from the university and attend her own convocation. She also earned a degree in animal welfare and worked as a dog trainer. Nearly 10 years into their sentence, the sisters hit a milestone.
So as of February 24th, 2003, they were eligible for parole, but they didn't get it. And when they did release them a couple of times, they imposed these onerous conditions on them, which, not surprisingly, they violated. So in 2020, by the time David Milgaard came to me, they had both served more than, they were actually by then, they'd served 28 years of their sentences.
And James, can you explain who David Milgaard is and how he became involved in this case?
David was a person who had spent 23 years in prison in Canada for a rape murder he did not commit, and ever since his exoneration, continued to advocate for the wrongly convicted. And Narissa and Odelia Cusance approached him in the summer of 2020. And David then asked me if I would take on their case.
So why did you believe in their innocence? What, you know, convinced you of that?
Taking into account the whole systemic racism involved in this, it wasn't a hard one. Once I had a chance to read the trial transcripts, the case to me stank. When I saw that they had been held in custody in the police station for 5 days, that in itself did it for me. I'd never heard of such a thing. Never.
And so what was your strategy for getting them out?
Odelia and Narissa had had their appeals dismissed in 1995, a year after their convictions, in a four-paragraph judgment of the Saskatchewan Court of Appeal, which kind of shows you how much attention was given to their case. The only method of challenging a conviction in Canada after all appeal processes have been exhausted and after their appeals have been lost, their only avenue of recourse was to go to the Minister of Justice, who's in our capital city in Ottawa, and ask him to review their convictions and determine whether they constituted a miscarriage of justice.
So you did that in 2022, and then what did you present to the minister?
We gave a whole list of reasons as to why these convictions constituted a miscarriage of justice. We pointed out that Canada's treatment of Indigenous peoples, and in this case was a classic abuse of Indigenous peoples, especially women. We talked about the impacts of systemic discrimination on the two of them in the police investigation.
And so to this day, does Jason still maintain that Odelia and Narissa were not involved?
Yes, I've met Jason a couple of times. Of course, he's now in his mid-40s. He's had a pretty difficult life since and bears, besides the guilt of stabbing Mr. Dolph, the guilt of having implicated Nerissa and Adelia by what he did. But yes, he maintains they had nothing to do with it. And his statement to that effect, which he put in writing, enabled us to bring a release application for them until the minister had made his final decision. And I'm glad to say that on March 27th of 2023, more than 30 years after their original arrest and imprisonment, they were released on bail. And they're both presently on bail.
The situation these two women found themselves in is unfortunately not unusual. According to Canada's Office of the Congressional Investigator, over 50% of incarcerated women in Canada are Indigenous. Indigenous people are historically more likely to be arrested for serious crimes, are rarely tried by their peers, and are more likely to be convicted. And like at the residential schools where they were first institutionalized, Indigenous people continue to face systemic racism and abuse throughout the prison and parole system.
Does the law in Canada seem to be more understanding now of, you know, the plight of Indigenous folks and what they have gone through and suffered, you know, particularly like Odelia and Nerissa winding up in a situation like this because of the systemic abuse?
To some extent, the answer is yes. Having said that, we have a huge problem in Canada because the Indigenous percentages in the prisons are going up and up and up, year by year by year. The denials of parole for the Indigenous are going up and up and up. The number of Indigenous being found to be dangerous offenders and subject to life sentences are going up and up and up. So whilst there may be more recognition, particularly with the present government that talks a great deal about the need for truth and reconciliation with our Indigenous people, at the criminal justice level, things are just terribly wrong.
But, you know, parole here is pretty awful as well. How is it in Canada? Why is it so bad if you're Indigenous?
Because they don't release you. That's the stats. I mean, there are many reasons for this. But a very simple part of a systemic discrimination is they have a whole system whereby they assess what they call the criminogenic factors of the individual, the likelihood that they will reoffend if released. And the assessments are conducted according to the thinking and customs of the white man, not the thinking, customs, and cultures of the Indigenous. And it's been proved very clearly that that means that the Indigenous are always over-assessed in terms of the likelihood of their reoffending, which automatically is then used to justify denying them parole. And then when they do release you, they release you on conditions that are almost bound to be violated. No alcohol, no drugs, curfews, those kinds of things, which people who are Indigenous, likely not very stable, don't have stable environments to return to, are going to be living potentially on reserves, almost bound to violate. They're caught drinking and you're on a life sentence. You're back in 2-3 years before you're next entitled to even be considered for parole.
Even though Odelia and Nerissa were released in March, they have not been exonerated of Joseph Dolph's murder. They're still living under parole conditions while they await ministerial review, hoping for the decision that would finally allow them to live fully free.
For me and my sister at this time, all I have is to wait.
Odelia's now back at home with Jay and their twin daughters. Nerissa's living with a good friend and advocate, Kim Bowden, and his wife, Rhonda.
He's the Congress of Aboriginal People of Canada vice president. And yeah, I just love him and Rhonda. You know, he's a great man. And I usually have a hard time trusting men.
After nearly 3 decades in prison, both sisters, now 51 and 49, are doing their best to adjust to life outside of prison walls while on parole.
For myself, it's a real, it's different because I'm so institutionalized that I'm used to everything coming. Like if I had to go see the doctor, I just had to go across the road and or go get groceries just across the hallway maybe. So, and now out here, it's hard to do. I've only ridden on a bus once since I've been out here. I have really bad anxiety and I notice that I get really irritable and stuff like that. So I don't really like being around people.
I understand that. You were in a prison with a lot of people for a long time.
How about you, Odelia? What kinds of things? You're a mom. What's that like?
It's been a challenge because I've been away from them for so many years. So it's rekindling with my daughters and getting to know them. And, you know, there's a lot of resentment, you know, and I feel them. Like, we have a good relationship. Like, I try to be my best with my girls and, you know, give them what they want. But it's hard. It's hard. To be honest, you know what? I feel useless sometimes. I feel like I, you know, so damn institutionalized. I don't know what to do on my own sometimes. I want to do things, make things different. I'm still hopeful about, you know, my future. But like I said, it's hard. It's a struggle when you just...
Yeah.
Like right now, I'm starting to get out of my bedroom because I'm so used to being in a room.
Yeah, that's what I do too. I spend a lot of room time. I do a lot of cell time still.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. I hear that from a lot of people who have been inside. It's scary.
Yeah. I always tell myself, you're okay. You're safe now. You're okay. It's going to be okay. I always tell myself that. My younger self.
Odelia and Narissa have found strength in going to conferences, meeting other exonerees, and telling their story.
I wanna help people, and I wanna be an advocate for women and children.
I remember when I was younger, when I was in jail, like even before I went to BC, I used to say, one day I'm gonna climb that mountain, you know, and that's what it meant for me is like, you know, one day I'm gonna get there to the top, you know. So
where is the top of that mountain for you?
Well, I'm there already.
Just as they did when they were children, the Cuzon sisters are still looking out for each other. And as they continue to fight for their innocence, both of them credit their own faith, as it was taught to them by their elders, with keeping them strong.
I follow my traditional Native spirituality, so I pray we call the Creator. So I do a lot of prayers and offering tobacco, and I teach my daughters. So.
Prayer is powerful. That's all we have when you're in prison, is prayer.
And prayer is powerful because I know nobody's greater than the Creator.
In 2020, more than 50 unmarked graves were discovered on the grounds of two residential schools near the Keyscoos Reserve, Fort Pelly and St. Phillips. Investigation is ongoing into who those children were, how they died, and how many more graves are yet to be discovered. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wordis, as well as senior producer Annie Chelsea, producer Kathleen Fink, story editor Hannah Beal, and researcher Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design are by Jackie Pauly, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company Number One.
Hello, this is Susie Essman and Jeff Garland.
I'm here.
And we are the hosts of the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. Now, we're going to be rewatching and talking about every single episode, and we're going to break it down and give behind-the-scenes knowledge that a lot of people don't know, and we're going to be joined by special guests, including Larry David and Cheryl Hines, Richard Lewis, Bob Odenkirk, and so many more, and we're going to have clips, and it's just going to be a lot of fun. So listen to the History of Curb Your Enthusiasm on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you happen to get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Dana Schwartz. You may know my voice from Noble Blood, Haleywood, or Stealing Superman. I'm hosting a new podcast, and we're calling it Very Special Episodes. A very special episode is stranger than fiction.
It sounds like it should be the next season of True Detective, these Canadian cops trying to solve this mystery of who spiked the chowder on the Titanic set.
Listen to Very Special Episodes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up, guys? Hola, ¿qué tal? It's your girl Cheekies from the Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies podcasts. And guess what? We're back for another season. Get ready for all new episodes where I'll be dishing out honest advice, discussing important topics like relationships, women's health, and spirituality. I'm sharing my experiences with you guys, and I feel that everything that I've gone through has made me a wiser person. And if I can help anyone else through my experiences, I feel like I'm living my godly purpose. Listen to Cheekies and Chill and Dear Cheekies on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.